Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
The United States Border Patrol has exciting and rewarding career opportunities with the nation's largest law enforcement organization.
Border Patrol agents enjoy great pay, outstanding federal benefits, and up to $20,000 in recruitment incentives.
If you are looking for a way to serve something greater than yourself, consider the United States Border Patrol. Learn more online at cbp.gov/careers/USBP.
That's cbp.gov/careers/USBP.
One of the clubs they used to say, if you're not quiet for the turn, if you're not quiet for turn, there'll be no bingo. All the people like from the church were outside protesting on the opening night here at the local in Bergen at the local theatre. Same at the Shaftesbury Theatre in London. There were people, Mary Whitehouse, you remember? All those people, it was a furore. It's quite extraordinary what it did around the world. Nobody in the 70s wanted that. They wanted the punk rock, but I didn't care. We met a lot of people in restaurants, and I spent a vast amount of money in restaurants as well. And we sat down. It was one of those, this is Freddie Mercury, this is Peter Straker, this is David, like that. And we said hello to each other. Freddie was in his furs, like that. We used to play tennis together because I was a member of a club called Hurlingham Club. They called Clodagh, my manager, and she said, could you ask your client, Peter Straker, and his friends if they could wear not such short shorts?
Peter Straker, welcome. This is an immense pleasure because I love interviewing people who've had such full and diverse and really, I don't know, wonderful lives and are still living their life to the full. And you are definitely one of those people. I've got to take you back because part of my podcast is always about childhood. And tell me how you actually came to live in Britain, because you came to Britain when you were a young child.
I came to Britain when I was about 11, I think, 10, 11, something like that, with my maternal grandmother and two siblings. Apparently, my parents got divorced and my mother won custody, and my mother came to England and she was studying voice because she was a leader singer. And she was quite young, and she went to New York first, and then she came to study with, I don't know the people, I must find this out, but because they were quite well known, and then she also ended up in Switzerland, in Geneva as well. So that's how I came here.
And so we came. Did your grandmother bring you up then?
Yes, no, my grandmother brought us over, but my mother and grandmother brought us up, yeah.
So you were brought up then in a musical family?
Yeah, yeah.
So what do you remember of that? What sort of, because that's obviously something that imbued into you.
Well, it's, what I can remember is when we first came to England, we moved into a very tiny flat and it was and then we moved in up into the suburbs, and we pianos and music, and that's all I grew up with, classical music basically. The background was classical and rather bombastic sometimes, and a lot of opera and a lot of Verdi around the house and stuff. So we just sung, you know, as children, you just do what your parents do. So you sing along with them. And rock and roll was something much later.
But what sort of values did your mother install in you?
Pretty strict Jamaican, tough. Yes, it was. Life was not. When I say tough, there were rules, and we abided by them. It's bringing up three boys who were very close in ages. It's a lot for women to bring up, because boys growing up, testosterone is and lots of fighting and lots of no, I'm doing this way, and no, you're doing it my way, and that is the way you do it. That is what you do when you're 16 and you know what you can do. You can leave home. Go away. If that's what you want, go. But until now, you do what I say. So we were quite strict.
Were you the youngest, the middle one, or the eldest?
I'm the eldest.
Oh, so you were the biggest tyrant then.
I was the one. The eldest one got a lot of junk thrown at him. I remember when one of my brothers, I said, but I wasn't allowed to do that, but you're making, he can do that. You know, it's all of that. It's yeah. So... I had a good childhood. I mean, I enjoyed my childhood, really, on the whole. I really had a good time.
Have you ever looked back and thought about where your drive may have come from?
I don't know if I have that much of a drive, Steve. I wonder about it. I really do.
For someone who's had a career which spans from 1968 to the present, I would say you have somewhat of a drive.
Maybe I've been lucky. Maybe I've been a bit lucky as well. I mean, there are things that you want to do and you like, and some things that you just happen to just fall into, and then you either decide I want to do that and you go ahead, or you just ignore it, as I've ignored lots of things in my life, and I probably thought I should have done them. So it's very difficult to assess, because looking back at in things, we revalue things, but it's not from a reality perspective. It's just, oh, whoa, but there's no reality, because the reality is what you do, what you're living at the time.
I mean, when I've seen interviews or read interviews with you, and you mentioned it there, things that you fall into, you always suggest that you fell into getting an audition for Hair. But what is really the truth? Had you already started to perform? What moves had you made before?
Well, I decided I wanted to be an actor. And I decided I was going to perform. And I went to, my mother knew somebody in a very big agent called Annie Callender, and she had a big agency in Regent Street in the 60s. And I went there to have a meeting with her. And it was, looking back now, it's quite bizarre, because I sat down with this lovely lady, and we talked and what I wanted to do, and I wanted to be an actor. And she said, why don't you go to drama school? And I said, I don't need to go to drama school. I can act.
I love the bravado. That's fantastic.
There you go. Well, that's the youth. That's youth. And I remember that. So she was very polite. And then she said, look, I have a young agent who's just joined me, and I think he is the one that should work with you. And his name was David Dion, and he's not with us anymore. And I was at the time, I then went decided, there's a friend of mine who said I could sing. So I started to do little clubs around England, and they were called working men's clubs, really. And I thought, well, look, I'll go and sing in these places because I'll get some experience. And particularly about Hair, I was singing in a club, in a working men's club somewhere down in Wales, and near Cardiff or Swansea, I can't remember. And he called me and he said, you know, it was on telephones. They had to call you in the digs that you were staying in. And he said, there's a show coming. There's a show, and I've put you up for it to audition for it. And he didn't tell me what the name. He said, well, can you come up? Can you come up on Thursday or Friday? So I got on a train, I came up to London, and he came with me, and I think we stood in a queue, and this was all new to me. I had no idea what I was doing. And I got on and I sang, and the song I sing, which I remembered, was Birth of the Blues, because I was a great admirer of Sammy Davis Jr. And so I thought that was one of the coolest songs in the world to sing. That's the song I sung.
Working in those working men's clubs, singing in those working men's clubs, I mean, that can't have been easy, because then they were notoriously tough and the audience didn't hold back.
They didn't. They were all right, though, you see. I mean, they probably hadn't seen anything quite like me before. I mean, in Wales, they did a little bit. But there was a lovely lady I met, and her husband or manager. And she, I remember her name was Cindy Williams, and she was quite a big singer down there in those days. And she took me under her wing a little bit. And I sang, and she would introduce me and things like that. So I'd go on, so everybody would go a little quiet. And I suppose, looking back, I mean, I had a pair of lungs on me. So, which is good. And so I used to sing, especially in Wales, they like your singing down there. And I used to sing songs like from West Side Story, like Tonight, Somewhere, Maria, and those. So I sang show songs and Old Man River, you know, those, that sort of wonderful combination, just songs that I'd heard. And I went out and bought the sheet music in Denmark Street for 1 and 6 pence or whatever it was, and just took it. And I went with a piano player and a drummer, and we picked up the rest of the people on the way. So that's what I remember. Yeah, and it was good fun. It was quite tough as well. Some clubs were really, I mean, they didn't want anybody to sing. They wanted to drink, and in the north of England, one of the clubs, they used to say, if you're not quiet for the turn, if you're not quiet for turn, there'll be no bingo. And I found that quite, I was rather unhappy with that. I think that really bingo was first and I was second. But yeah, to get to bingo, they had to be quiet. We had to go sometimes. I did lunch times as well on a Sunday. And it was just packed with blokes, because women were cooking for them to roll in at 3 o'clock. No, yes.
Hair was revolutionary, and it came at a time where the censorship laws had changed. And in a sense, it came at a time where the world was changing. How important was it, do you feel, not only for your career, but how important do you think hair was as a musical in terms of society?
Well, I think it revolutionized it revolutionized, because we worked with a great director who I was, and we were so lucky, because when I got, after we got here, most of us, we auditioned 9 times for that show. And when we got here, we worked with a director called Tom O'Horgan, who was part of the La Mama troupe in New York. And my friend Annabelle Levington had worked with him as well. So he came with a lot of information, and we had a 3-month rehearsal period by accident, because of the laws of opening the show before the Lord Chamberlain's office was abandoned or made extinct, which was going to be in, I think it was the October or end of September, I think it was, of 1968. So we learned a lot from Tom. And about theatre and what theatre was like, and what it was had become with working with microphones on stage, live microphones, like you were doing a show, and a live band on stage. And this is all new, because I hadn't ever done a show before. So it just became part of my world and my reality. And so of course, with the language, and it was slightly irreverent, as you know, it poked fun, but at religion and the standards of what people thought and how parents behaved to their children, and it put together the biggest thing. Today we call it diversity, but it put black and white people together, Indians, Chinese, all together on the stage as a unit, and we were called a tribe, and that I remember. And you met so many people from all different parts of the world, and people in our show, there were a lot of West Indians, because I was from Jamaica, and a couple of Jamaicans and people from St. Lucia, and it was fantastic.
I remember talking to Jimmy Helms, and he said he was also, I don't know whether he was in the same production, he was in America in Hair, I think. And he told me that this was the moment that changed his life, because the reaction to it, and I remember as a young child that Hair was, you know, front pages, the nudity, the, you know, the outrage and all this sort of stuff. But actually, it played into the hands of the people who were performing, because it gave them a push and gave them a place in the market, in a sense.
Well, it broke, I mean, basically it broke all the bounds that I mean, for instance, I remember this, I'm talking to you now because I'm in Norway at the moment, staying at my friend's house, and we've been very good friends now for 53 years, because I came and did Hair in Norway because there weren't any black people. So I was imported because I'd done the London production, and it changed a lot of things over here as well with people, because just like in London, the same people that were the antiest, all the people like from the church were outside protesting on the opening night here at the local in Bergen at the local theatre. Same at the Shaftesbury Theatre in London, there were people. Mary Whitehouse, you remember? All those people. It was a furore. It's quite extraordinary what it did around the world.
London must have been a really fascinating and interesting place at that time, because the community of artists was fairly small. So I presume in a lot of ways you bumped into other people all the time. What was special about London during that period of the late 60s?
Looking back, I mean, without realizing it, it became part of our lives, because it was just so, it was quite exciting, and it was noisy, loud, brash, but so much was going on artistically, really, and musically, that you just landed in, you were there, and you just did certain things. There were lots of things that also went, I remember some nights, especially on a Friday and a Saturday, because on Friday and Saturdays we had two shows together with half an hour in between. So we did four shows in a block, and that was quite exhausting. The first two or three weeks was exciting, but after that it takes its toll. But I remember one of my great friends was Marsha Hunt, and we used to stand, Marsha had this huge hair. My hair grew eventually, but I started with very short hair. And but as within 6 months of being in the show, I became a hair person as well. And Friday and Saturday nights, we couldn't get taxis outside the Shaftesbury. They just turned their lights off as soon as they saw us. So moments like that were quite tough. So we had to organize getting home together. Elaine Page was in the show, and she lived near me in Palmer's Green, Barnet, so she would drop me off. So we got certain things that we knew that we weren't in. And if you stayed out at night, which I did, I went out a lot and I ate a lot in because after the shows, I had too much energy. And so I enjoyed the nightlife.
I mean, restaurants were where you met everyone.
Yes, restaurants, we met a lot of people in restaurants. And I spent a vast amount of money in restaurants as well.
One thing that stuck out to me when I, you know, read about you and the roles that you've taken on, and I wonder whether you took them on because of the roles or because of the music, because you've taken on quite a lot of pioneering roles. Hud, for example, then you've got the role in Girl Boy in 1972, which was a sort of pioneering queer movie. Yeah. Frankenfurter, the Rocky Horror Show. And you even played the Acid Queen, didn't you, in 2017? I mean, these are really exceptional roles. And I wonder whether you chose things because of the role or you choose things because of the music.
A combination of both. I mean, Tommy was one of the great things that I did after Hair, really, which is quite a long time after Hair. But my friend Helen Montague, who was the producer, she spoke to me and she said, look, I would love you, darling. She's Australian, God bless her. She's gone to do this show. And we made the deal, actually, on New Year's Eve in a club. And I said, yes, I'll do it. And I started rehearsing, and it was that's the first time I did it, when I did the West End at the Queen's Theatre, and it was great. And then I met Pete Townsend, and he's a force to be reckoned with, as the world knows, and I was just lucky, and you learn a lot, and Roger Daltrey I met, and John Entwistle. I mean, it was all of those times, and there were a whole lot of people in those days, because I met, but I didn't realize I'd met him until much later. But people like Lionel Bart, you know, who wrote Oliver and stuff like that. And it's just a potpourri of people, and you just meet people and you talk and you sit down, you eat and you drink. And I don't think it's changed that much, do you?
Oh, I don't meet that many people.
Oh, stop it.
But anyhow, I think this interview's about you. Let's go back to after Hair, because that is when you also started recording.
Yes.
How was that period for you? Was it something that you really wished to be, a recording artist, or were you more of coming from this acting direction and wanting to be an actor?
I don't think I wanted to be a recording artist. I could sing, and so my manager is quite pushy and good. I'm glad he was. And working in Hair, I also met the great Peter Knight Jr., who was with Polydor, and David said, "Look, why he should start recording?" And I said, "Well, yes, let's start recording." And so we did a whole heap of singles in that time period, in about 3 or 4 years, and some of them were good and some of them weren't. And I had a lot of problems with the BBC. They never played any of my stuff, basically. And if you weren't on one of those playlists, basically you're a dead duck. And that is when I think it's still going on now. And I don't say this with any rancor or anything. It's just the system it is. And if you ain't lucky enough to be played, nobody hears of you, and that is the end of you. So I think it's also very difficult for a lot of artists who actually have this craving to do things. And when you just, somebody at the top of some structure just decides that's not good enough. And actually, that's the only thing I wish we could change in the music industry, but it's ever thus, and you just have to live with it, or you just don't bother.
A lot of it's down to timing, though, isn't it? Because it depends on what sort of music you're doing and what is deemed in at the time, what they're willing to play.
But somebody has made themselves the arbiter of taste. So that's an interesting idea as well. So yes, it's a combination of everything. You're absolutely right. I mean, my thing is, if you're not there, it doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't mean it's bad or it's not worth it. You're just left on the sidewalk to drown.
Drown you did not. That's absolutely sure. How did you get to work with the Alan Parsons Project?
They approached me and asked me, they liked my voice. And he just said, would I come? And we went and did this work at Abbey Road Studios, which was just fantastic. And I did it over 2 or 3 nights to days, and it was great. And that was a great experience as well, because it came from nowhere. And I didn't know anything about the Alan Parsons Project at the time. Because again, I was young. I just didn't, and you know, I wasn't. There's certain things you know, and certain things you didn't. And then I found out about it, and that was a great experience. I love that. And in fact, I've been working this year. Probably I should, with Andy Mitchell. I mentioned him because he's great, and I'm going to redo it, I think. But I don't know if I should have said that. But there you are. I've done it. I've said it.
Brilliant.
At Abbey Road as well. We're doing it in Abbey Road as well, which is quite remarkable.
I mean, obviously, a lot of your interviews centre on one of your best friends, or your best friend in the 70s, and Freddie Mercury, of course. Yeah. So could you tell me about the moment that you met him and what your connection was?
I met him in a restaurant in Fulham Road and it used to be it's called Provans, and it was next, I can say this, next to a cemetery. The Provans was next, because Provans, as I remember, was a long restaurant, and I think this is where they put the bodies in the morgue before they put it into the thing. And it was a very successful restaurant, and I was there with my then manager at the time, called David Evans, and Freddie was there with John Reed, who managed Queen, as you know, and Elton John, and they were leaving the restaurant, and we had just arrived. And we sat down, it was one of those, this is Freddie Mercury, this is Peter Straker, this is David, like that. And we said hello to each other. Freddie was in his furs, like that. And so, and we just said hello to each other, and it was all right. And then we met again, subsequently, about a week later, in another restaurant, which eat, and called September, which was opposite Provans, and where a lot of rock and roll people went. We were in there, and we met through some mutual friends and said hello to each other and then joined tables. And then we just started to go out and meet, and everywhere we went, we sort of met, and we became pals.
The United States Border Patrol has exciting and rewarding career opportunities with the nation's largest law enforcement organization.
Earn great pay with outstanding federal benefits and up to $20,000 in recruitment incentives. Learn more online at cbp.gov/careers/USBP.
As a performer on stage, he was larger than life. He was an enormous, you know, amazing character who could connect to everyone in the audience through his massive personality on stage. What was he like in private?
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Privately, he was highly intelligent, and obviously, and he loved music, theater, opera, ballet. I mean, everything, all the things that I liked, and a few of us liked, and also tennis and football and things. We used to play tennis together because I was a member of a club called Hurlingham Club, which my manager, she was a member, and we used to go in and play tennis there. It's a famous club, Hurlingham. It's where the pre-Wimbledon and everything. And I get a lovely story is they called Clodagh, my manager, and she said, could you ask your client, Peter Straker, and his friends if they could wear not such short shorts? We were trying, because it was really a bastion of establishment. So we had to dress down.
Those 70s tennis shorts were very short.
Yes, they were short. It's like football. So with all of that, we know, and that's, I think, why Freddie and I got on very well, because even when he was touring and stuff, we'd speak to each other on the phone, because he was sometimes in New York and one of the Grand Slams was on, and we'd talk about all. So I was lucky. We just had a nice mutual interest in quite a wide range of stuff.
So how did it come about that he produced your music?
Or I asked him.
What, directly? You just said...
Yes, I just said to him one day, listen, would you produce an album for me? And this was in my flat in Hurlingham Road. And I remember, and he said, Well, I'd love to, because he'd been to see me singing and stuff with my band. And he said, I'd love to. But he said, I don't think I'm the right person at this stage because Queen, he said, aren't very, because of punk rock, that sort of glam, that big bombastic thing was not fashion. He said, when our records aren't being played and everything. I said, I don't care. I said, I'd love you to produce it. So my friend John Reed brokered the deal with EMI Records, and we had a three deal to do. And then Freddie said, would you mind if Roy Thomas Baker does it with me, because I've never produced a whole album before. And so we went in into the studio, and the first album we did together. It was great fun. I learned a lot because I knew nothing about recording. I mean, I'd done singles and stuff before, but not making an album. And we decided to do, I said, well, what should we do? He said, well, what you should do is learn to write songs. He said, that's where the money is. And I started to write a little bit, and he helped a little. And but we decided that we're going to do an album with the stuff that I was singing and performing at the time, because I just like, I've probably against, it might be to my detriment, but I'd like doing slightly difficult things and not going down just the norm. I quite like entertaining, and I just found that the stuff that we were doing, working in clubs and going to the Edinburgh festivals and stuff like that, people really liked, because it was eclectic, and it was a combination of stuff that I had written that Michael Addison, my guitarist and co-producer and very good pal, worked together. And Freddie said, I think, well, let's do an album that shows the stuff that you've been doing. Because he and Queen, they came up to see me in Edinburgh as well. And he said, let's do that on and put that on the album. So it was quite a thing. And I suppose at the time, nobody in the 70s wanted that. They wanted the punk rock, but I didn't care. I was very proud of the albums that I did then. And I was lucky, I thought, to work with some very great producers.
I mean, Roy Thomas Baker is incredible, yes. Isn't it? Three of the biggest Queen albums, Bohemian Rhapsody. And when you say that no one wanted your music at the time, no one actually wanted Bohemian Rhapsody at first, did they?
Yeah, no, they didn't. But then I suppose Kenny Everett was the person who really broke. I'm guessing, I remember, because he kept playing it on his program on Capital Radio. Do you remember? Nearly every weekend, and I became good friends with Kenny as well, because he tried to break a couple of my records as well, but we had trouble. I have a lot of theories, but I don't want to go into that now. Let's be jolly.
Okay. How? I mean, people often ask when they've met some of these, you know, massively iconic people in the world. You met, I think you met Bowie as well. Obviously, Freddie Mercury, you were a close friend. They often ask what you learned from them, but what do you feel that Freddie Mercury learned from you?
I have no idea. Probably looking back, a lot more about theatre and theatre. Going to the theatre, and we went to the theatre. We went to see something called Let My People Go. Let My People Come, I think it's a show. And I remember this very vividly. We went out into the street in the interval to have a drink, because it was so full. And I said, come on, let's go and have a drink. And at the end of the interval, we were going back into the theatre, and Freddie said to me, I can't go back in. I said, what do you mean? What do you mean? He said, I've left the place. I can't go back in. I said, what do you mean? What do you mean? So we never went back to see the second half of the show. So I had to tell him that, in fact, you can leave the theatre and come back in, because you have your ticket. It's your rite of passage. And it's one of those lovely, naive, I was furious at the time. But that's it. And Mr. Mercury said he's not going back into the theatre, and we'd gone together. So it's So we left. So little things like that. But then that's just funny. That's just one of those funny incidents. But the theatre, because I went to see a lot of theatre. I was going to see lots of theatre. I went to National Theatre and stuff. So he came, and he came to see lots of stuff that I was in, performing in the theatre. I mean, he travelled. I did a strange musical up in Newcastle, and he came up that day. His chauffeur, and they came up, saw the show, and we had dinner, and he came back to London. He went to Sheffield when I did The Wiz. He came up for the opening night and stayed overnight in the hotel. And so he is as a friend. I mean, he was really just looking back, and I haven't spoken about this for I haven't spoken about. I just didn't realize he came down to Bristol to see me in doing in Julius Caesar, and he would just drive anywhere if he was not working and just turn up, which is what friends do anyway.
He had all these diverse interests, which were, you know, like obviously later on doing Barcelona, he had an interest in opera, which came, you know, into Bohemian Rhapsody. Were you around at these high points in his life, you know, when Bohemian Rhapsody just became the biggest song on the planet?
I wasn't then, because I just got to know him when Bo Rap was becoming big. And I remember going, the first time I saw Queen on stage was that Christmas when Bo Rap was big. And that's the first time he invited me. And
were you there at Live Aid?
Yes, I was. Yeah. Yes, I was at Live Aid, and that was fantastic. I remember I had to leave early at Live Aid, but I saw them go on because I was doing a show at the Theatre Royal Stratford East. And it's just because we'd Live Aid, and then all of a sudden I realised that it was getting late, and I was due to perform with the other actors, Belinda Lang, Fiona Hendy, and George Costigan. And I left, and my driver was taking me, and we got stuck in traffic. And Stratford East from Wembley is quite a journey. And I called and I phoned and I said, "Listen, I'm not going to make the thing." And there were no understudies. So they went in and asked the audience, which is very nice. They said I was stuck at Live Aid, and would they wait? So they gave them drinks, and an hour later we went up and had a ball, but that was Live Aid. That's what I remember. And then after that, we then went on to a club. I went back to Freddie's house, and then we went on to David Bowie came over, and then we all went on to a club to celebrate Live Aid somewhere else. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So I was there.
Fantastic. I mean, the 80s, the 80s had two sides to it for me. I was in London, and I would go to gay clubs and friends would disappear. Do you know what I mean? You'd go to a club, yes, and you'd communicate with someone. The week later, they weren't there. And then 6 months later, because you didn't know them necessarily well, 6 months later, you find out that they had died.
Yeah.
How difficult were the 80s for you in that way? I'm not saying this just because of Freddie, but I think it was such a difficult period for many of us during that era.
I think the reason it was so difficult is it was something that, first of all, we didn't understand. If you almost make a comparison to today, the pandemic, nobody understood what was going on. We still don't understand what happened in the last 3 or 4 years. And that's bringing it up to date. Nobody understood. We heard, you get the headlines of this awful gay plague, and it's men, and it's this, and all, and again, that's what the papers write about. They're still doing it. There's a war happening now, and the stuff that's coming out, I can't watch it anymore. It's awful. Any war is awful, but it's the way it's reported, and especially in the West, how it's reported. Some things are reported. It was. Terrifying, because a lot of people that you knew just disappear, and they died very quickly, and some people lingered, and they went through hell. Some of my actor friends, well, quite a few died, Ian Charleston and people. It's something that I still very difficult to grasp. because, and of course, there was no medication, you know, stuff wasn't happening, but they were trying to do it as quickly as possible. But then it did work for some, and it didn't work. And some people were just unlucky, I suppose. In the long run, that's with life and death. Some of us are lucky we're alive and we're fairly healthy. Some of us are alive and we're not healthy. And it's a lottery.
Can you remember the last time you saw Freddie?
Yes. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay. What memory sticks in your head? Because if I think about people I've known that have passed, you know, or particularly my mother, the memories change after their death, that you actually hold on to different things as it goes along. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
you don't remember the last time. You know, it's uncomfortable, and I completely understand that. But you remember something else. So what sticks in your head as if you think about him, what comes up?
Life comes up. It's just the joy of life and just living, and just living the moment and the time. And I still try and do that as much as possible and that's what I remember about him and about a lot of other people who I've lost and who I've loved, like my mother. I remember certain things about her and my aunts and people that you're very close to. Usually, most of the time, really a good time, an enjoyable time and really great fun and hope and joy and living. I mean, we moan. I moan like fuck, you know, but I still try and live and I still try and enjoy myself. And when I say enjoy myself, I don't mean like in a flippant way, but just enjoy being alive. And that's all I can do to justify my being. So with all my moaning and my blah, blah, and I do moan, I tell you, I just try and just look at the good things in life. I mean, I'm sitting in my friend's house now, and you can't see it, but just overlooking, it's very dull day, but there's just water and fjords and mountains all around. And it's stunningly beautiful. And you just go, well, you know what? I'll take part of that. And I've experienced this, and this is a good day.
Well, you've experienced so much. I mentioned, you know, you obviously met Bowie. You were friends with Donna Summer. Can you tell me about, I mean, I watched that the documentary recently on, I think it was on Netflix or Amazon, on Donna Summer. Wonderful documentary. And it brought up so many memories for me in terms of her music and remembering her as a character on stage. What was, and in that documentary, it showed very much two sides of her. The sort of God-fearing side, the yes, one who had a strong belief. And then this other person who would be singing very sexual songs. Yeah.
Yes.
What was she like as a person?
She was great. She was a wonderful person. I met her actually again in Hair, because I was in Hair in London, and she came to the stage door, and she was in German here in Munich, she and her boyfriend at the time. And they came and they saw the show in the afternoon. And this is what Hair did to lots of people. She came and then she stayed in my dressing room, in our dressing room, the boys' dressing room. And at the end of the show, I said, let's go to dinner. We went to dinner. And then the next day we're staying in a hotel in Earl's Court. And I just said, you can't stay in the hotel, so come and stay with me. And in those days, that's what the Hair people did. We just all just went, boom. And then, they stayed with me then for the next 6-7 days. And I had a one bedroom flat, and there were a lot of people staying, and just people just, and it's something that still, in a strange way, still goes on. You just get on with it, and that. So she was wonderful, and we just stayed friends all those years. And she was very successful, and sometimes she came to London, and she would ring me up, and I'd go to her concerts, and we'd go out shopping, and lots of stuff. And when she had the children and they're growing up, I didn't see her too much, because when you have children, your attention goes to children. But we went to stay with her and Bruce In Tennessee, where they lived. And in fact, we recorded something together, and I've only just found it, and I've forgotten I had it. So I don't know yet, but we just did something that she'd written for me, she and Bruce, and I don't know, I found it, so I've got to speak to him. It might be interesting, it might not be, but no, it was great. I was very sad when she died, because I didn't realize she was there, but she said she didn't want me to know and certain other people to know. And that's her prerogative. And that was a shock. And she's greatly missed.
One of the great loves of your life has been Jacques Brel's music.
Oh, yes.
Tell me why.
When I first saw pictures and films of him performing, passion, the absolute passion and belief in what he did and what he sang. And in a way, I try and do that. I'd like to think I try and do that in music, to be honest. I'd just like to think that's what I... if you don't have a passion, if you don't believe in what you're doing, however wrong it might be, or however, then it's a waste of time. And I've wasted time as well. So, like most people. So, just passion, the passion of the man. It's just, I wish I'd met him, and I could have met him. And I was, do you know when you know people, or I was in such awe, and I didn't go to Paris. I just found a way of not going. And so stupid. I'd like to shoot myself now, but I wouldn't. I won't.
How much does age, experience, and the development of your voice play into being able to perform those types of songs better today than you could have performed them when you were younger?
Well, I did start young, and I didn't know what I was singing about, but then so did he. I mean, basically, when you think, there's one of the great songs he's written, is called Ne me quitte pas, If You Go Away. I mean, he wrote that at the age of 19 or 20. And that's spent time. So I was singing these songs when I was young. Now they mean a lot more to me. This year I'm of a certain age. People they're talking about it. I won't put numbers on ages. They can say and believe whatever they do. But I'm doing two of his songs to celebrate this birthday on the 26th of October. I'm performing at Lascaux. In London, it's one of those highly priced things, and the money is a charity which is very close to my heart. Is the Chelsea Pensioners, the Chelsea Hospital Fund, and the money is going there. And Dan Llewellyn's Hall has done a portrait of me, and it's being unveiled, and I'm singing and sort of stuff, and I'm reworking two of his songs to do, and when I just realized how difficult it is even now trying to do it. But it's a challenge. Listen, Steve, we have to challenge ourselves all the time, and if you don't, well, you might as well be dead.
Exactly. I mean, I should end there because that's a perfect ending, but I want to talk about the single that you have out, which is called Just Spend This Night With Me.
Just Spend. Have you heard it yet?
I have. I've just listened to it just before. So it's something that's been modernized in a sense. It's been made into a sort of dance version. What was the thinking behind that?
We've had a lot of it's gone through a lot of stuff. When I first did it, I think it was in the 90s. It's just a song that I'd written mostly, and Michael Allison helped write. We worked it together, and it came up, and I can say because. One of my friends is Rolf Skogstrand in Norway, and he said to me, that's a really good song, and he's a good musician, he's a good song. So I did do it, and so we did it a couple of times, and then I've done it in different forms, and then we decided this year, I said, Michael, I said, let's do this song. Everybody seems to like it when we perform it, so let's find a different way. So I re-recorded, I did a new vocal, and we did it, we knew what we wanted to do, and then Michael just honed it together, my producer, Michael Allison, and it's now what it is, and I'm very pleased with it. I very rarely say that, but I'm quite thrilled with it. It's all right, whether anybody will play it, because if you can't get on a playlist somewhere, as we said, and I haven't got a huge high profile in real terms of sort of, but I like it and I love it and I love the thumping bass to it. I just love it. So, yes, please. But
it's been wonderful to meet you, Peter Straker. And what I love about you is your energy, your positivity, even though you moan sometimes, I haven't seen that side of you, but your positivity.
You don't want to see it.
And the way that you're also, you seem to be looking into the future. And what's really interesting is being able to use such a sort of wonderful back catalogue. And the other thing I love about you is your voice. It's one of the most incredible voices. And I think it's a gift. And thank you for sharing that gift. Peter Straker.
Oh, thank you, Steve. That's very kind of you, and I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's grand, grand to talk to you. And thank you. Thank you.
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews. And here is where you can connect.
We made USAA insurance for veterans like James. When he found out how much USAA was helping members save, he said,
"It's time to switch.
We'll help you find the right coverage at the right price. USAA. What you're made of, we're made for. Restrictions apply."
At Sleep Outfitters Outlet, great sleep is a big deal. Save 40 to 60% every day on every Sealy, Stearns & Foster, and Tempur-Pedic. Queens as low as $249. Customer exchanges, closeouts, and floor samples. Inventory changes daily, so come in for your dream deal today. With no credit needed financing, expert advice, and up to 60% off retail, it's never been easier to get the sleep and savings you deserve. Go to sleepoutfittersoutlet.com for financing details and to find a store near you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.